TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Robert Fisk, The Fantasy War, Liberation, Weapons of Mass Destruction, and Democracy. When Robert Fisk flew into San Francisco in mid-October 2003 to give the talk you're about to hear, he was held up in customs for an hour. The agents insisted on reading his notebook and letters, maybe in an attempt to get first-hand information about the situation in Iraq that they can't find in the U.S. press. Fisk is used to such reception. For quite a while, the name of the world-renowned British journalist on passenger lists triggers special attention. Fisk has reported from the Middle East in print and film for the BBC for over a quarter century. His paper, The London Independent, had just sent him again to Baghdad. He was there during the war and now reports from the unfolding guerrilla war. He pays equal attention to the lives of ordinary Iraqis and to the machinations of the new power brokers and, as you will hear right now, even follows the recall process in California. Here is Robert Fisk.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your welcome. You know, Iraqis know something about your new governor of California. Arnold Schwarzenegger went to Baghdad a few weeks ago. And what did he tell the U.S. 3rd Infantry Division? You, he told American soldiers at Baghdad airport, you are the Terminators. This was fully reported in the Baghdad press, and I leave you to think what the Iraqis felt about that. So, news from the front. I've just got back from Baghdad. The Americans, as you know, are being attacked daily. There's still only 12 hours electricity a day. There's shooting across the capital at night and all across the lands which surround the capital, Baghdad. And 2 weeks ago, largely unmentioned and unpublished here in the West, the Anglo-American authorities in Iraq used a legal committee to organize press censorship. Officially, of course, it's not called that. His so-called Coalition Provisional Authority has set up a legal committee to examine how restrictions can be clamped on Iraq's new and free press to eliminate, in the words of one diplomat, the wilder stories that might provoke incitement to hatred. 2 weeks ago, the Al Jazeera Arab satellite channel was summoned to Paul Bremer's palace. In fact, they received a phone call from Nabil Houri, the State Department official attached to Bremer's office, in which he said, if you don't come to us, we'll bring you. And they did bring them. They were handed a letter, apparently poorly written, which included the following questions. Do you have advance notice of terrorist attacks? Have you paid money to terrorists? Have you been inciting violence? What Al Jazeera have been doing, of course, is reporting on the thousands of Iraqi civilians killed since liberation by thieves, looters, and by US troops. In theory, and if you listen to Donald Rumsfeld today, the news from Iraq is all great. Oil production is up to 1 million barrels a day. Baghdad Airport is preparing to reopen. Every university in Iraq is functioning again. The health services are recovering rapidly. Mobile phones have made their first appearance in Baghdad before the Americans switched them off. There's an Iraqi interim council up and hobbling. But there's a kind of looking glass fantasy to all these announcements from the Coalition Provisional Authority. The weasel-worded title with which the American-led occupation powers cloak their decidedly undemocratic and right-wing credentials. Take the oil production figures. General Ricardo Sanchez, the US commander in Iraq, even chose to use these statistics in his Great Day for Iraq press conference, the one in which he triumphantly announced that 200 soldiers in Mosul had killed the sons of Saddam rather than take them prisoner. But General Sanchez was talking rubbish. Although oil production was indeed standing at 900 barrels per day, albeit 100,000 barrels per day less than the Sanchez version, It fell in July to 750,000. When Paul Bremer announced the other day, alongside Colin Powell, that the previous day's oil production figure was 1,680,000, oil ministry officials privately told me it was actually 788,000. The books are being cooked. The drop in oil production is caused by power cuts, which are going to continue for much of the year, export smuggling, and most of all, sabotage. The result? Iraq, with the world's second highest reserves of oil, is now importing fuel from other oil-producing countries to meet domestic demands. Now let's turn to my favourite subject, Baghdad Airport. For the first time last week, I actually flew out of it. I'll tell you about that in a minute. Sure, it's going to reopen. But it just happens that the airport, with its huge American military base and brutal US prison camps, comes under nightly grenade and mortar attack. No major airline would dream of flying its aircraft into the facility in these circumstances. So weird things are happening. The Iraqis are told, for example, that the first long-distance flights will be run by Transcontinental Airlines. Not exactly like British Airways or United, is it? A name oddly similar to the CIA's transport airline in Vietnam, which is reported to be a subsidiary of US Airlines, and the only flight will be between Baghdad and, wait for it, but don't try to guess, the old East Berlin airport of Schönefeld. A British outfit calling itself Mayhill Aviation, doesn't quite trip off the tongue like British Airways, does it, has printed advertisements in the Iraqi press saying it intends to fly a Boeing 747 once a week from Gatwick to Basra. London Gatwick is not our most important airport. A route which suggests it is going to be British military personnel and their families who end up using the plane. When I left Baghdad Airport for Jordan on a once-a-day flight on Royal Jordanian, an Airbus, I was chatting beside the runway to five American Special Forces officers. Cheerful guys. He said, "I guess the mortars will start arriving soon." I said, "What? Mortars? In daylight? I know they fire mortars every night at Baghdad Airport." Then the first mortar shell came bang right next to the runway. And then four more. And then an Apache helicopter came by looking to rocket the people firing the mortars. According to the Special Forces men, there was a 5-mile safety radius around Baghdad Airport until about 3 months ago. That radius has now condensed to a 2-mile safety radius. The point being, of course, that Americans are being more and more attacked in the 2 to 5 mile section. And 2 miles only gives a very narrow edge to prevent aircraft being hit by the shoulder-fired missiles, which have an 8,000-foot range, which, of course, airlines don't want to be in touch with. It's interesting that all around the airport now, and all down the main highways, Highway 1 up to Mosul, Highway 8 down to Hilla, the Americans have cut down tens of thousands of trees so that guerrillas can't hide in them. This is exactly what the Israelis did in southern Lebanon. Orange trees, palm trees, pine trees, all the trees planted over the past 20 years around the airport and on the main highways are now down. American military didn't risk getting hit in this because they got Iraqi subsidiaries to do all the work. The wood was then sold to bakers in Baghdad for the making of bread. When we did eventually take off, well, for 2 hours, the pilot on Royal Jordanian declined to do so. I don't blame him. Five mortars around the airport in the morning is quite a lot. It's bright daylight, 11 o'clock, not nighttime attacks. Instead of taking off as one would from San Francisco International, the plane and Airbus suddenly started going like this. You remember the corkscrew when you're undoing your bottle of wine? Well, you go round and round the corkscrew. I was sitting next to the window, and Baghdad Airport was down there. And a little bit later on, it was upside down there again, the wrong way round. Things are getting better. Baghdad Airport has reopened. Open universities are good news, of course. And few would blame Bremer for summarily firing the 436 professors who were members of the Ba'ath Party. But then, it turned out there wouldn't be enough qualified professors to go round. Quite a number of the 436 were party men in name only, we were told. So at Mustan Saria University, for example, the very same purged professors were rehired after filling out forms routinely denouncing the Ba'ath Party. Bremer seems to have a habit of reversing his own solemn decisions, having triumphantly announced that he'd sacked the entire Iraqi army. He was humiliatingly forced to put the whole lot back on rations in case they all decided to attack American soldiers in Iraq. Health services? Well, yes. The new Iraqi health service is being encouraged to rehabilitate the country's hospitals and clinics. Jolly good. But an American company called Abt Associates has turned up in Baghdad to give Ministry of Health technical assistance, support USAID, and rapid response grants to address health needs in-country. Needless to say, it has decreed that all medical equipment must accord with US medical standards and modifications, which means that all new hospital equipment must come from America, not from Europe. Nice one. And then there's the mobile phones. Just 2 months ago in Baghdad, my roaming Lebanese cellular pinged into life at midnight. And after a few hours of scrambled voice communication, picked up mobile companies in the Gulf. Less than a week later, however, the Americans ordered the whole system shut down because the Bahrain operating company, by opening its service so early, was supposedly not giving other bidders a fair chance at the contract. You can think of one or two countries that obviously wanted to be in on this. Last week, the Interim Council, as it's called, announced that there were three companies which would get licenses to operate the mobile phone systems of Iraq, the new Iraq, as we have to call it. They were all from Arab countries. What he didn't mention is that one has a controlling stake in it from an American company, and the other, Motorola, and the other from a British company, Vodafone. So the Grand Alliance has got two-thirds of the phone system. Of course, Iraqis protest at much of this. They protest in the streets, especially against the aggressive American military raids. And they protest in the press. Much good does it do them. When ex-Iraqi soldiers demonstrated outside Bremer's office at the former presidential palace, US troops shot two of them dead. When Fallujah residents staged a protest as long ago as April, American military, 82nd Airborne, shot 14 dead. Another 11 were later gunned down in Mosul. During two demonstrations against the presence of US troops near the shrine of Imam Hussein at Karbala, American soldiers shot dead another three. What a wonderful thing it is to speak your own minds, General Sanchez said of the demonstrations across Iraq. Maybe he was exhibiting a black sense of humor. All this might be incomprehensible if one forgot that the whole illegal Iraqi invasion had not been hatched up by a bunch of right-wing and pro-Israeli ideologues in Washington, and that Bremer, though not a member of their group, fits squarely into the same bracket. Bremer, remember, is an anti-terror expert. Now he's got more terrorism around him than he's ever seen in his life before, and he can do absolutely nothing about it. Hence Paul Wolfowitz, one of the prime instigators of this disastrous war. He was among the loudest, as you know, to beat the drum over the weapons of mass destruction, which don't exist, is now trying to deflect attention from his disastrous advice to the US administration by attacking the press. In particular, that pesky, uncontrollable channel Al Jazeera. Its reports, he now meretriciously claims, amount to incitement to violence, and, a later addition, incitement to violence against American troops. And that's even worse than incitement to violence, you see. Knowing full well, of course, that Bremer has officially made incitement to violence an excuse to close down any newspaper or television station he doesn't like. I recall all this because of the way in which any of our reports during this last war, which suggested the Americans may have been bombing civilians rather than military targets, were immediately attacked by the US or British governments as reports from behind enemy lines, written by journalists who were supposedly acting as Saddam's propaganda henchmen, duped by his secret services into lying about Anglo-American air raids. The British government tried hard to persuade our own editor not to let us report from the Iraqi side of the line. Matter of fact, the summer before, summer of 2002, I had a chat with my editor, Simon Kellner, in London, and told him that if the war started, there would be a letter from the British Ministry of Defence telling him, in all good faith, that they deeply feared for the lives of correspondents who were in Baghdad reporting from the Iraqi side. And I actually wrote him a spoof letter. You know, "Dear Mr. Kellner, we are deeply concerned, etc." This would be what he'd get. Those letters duly arrived at editorial offices in London, and to my great delight, the Daily Telegraph and the Times withdrew their correspondence. Simon Kellner called me up in Baghdad. He said, "You won't believe this. You were five words wrong." I think I should go and work for the British Ministry of Defence. I love the line from the interim council who said that because of their indiscretions, Al Jazeera would not be permitted to come to interim council press conferences anymore. Many of us wish to be punished as soon as possible in the same way. Indeed, newspapers which have offended the Americans have been raided by US troops in just the same way that the Americans have conducted raids on the offices of the Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, whose leader, Ayatollah Muhammad al-Hakim, is a member of the famous interim council. Not exactly a bright way of keeping a prominent Shiite cleric on board. But the council itself is already the subject of much humour in Baghdad, not least because its first acts included the purchase of cars for all its members, nice cars, of course, a decision to work out of a former presidential palace, and this, the lunatic brainchild of the Pentagon-supported and convicted fraudster Ahmed Shalabi, the declaring of a national holiday every April 9th to honour Iraq's liberation from Saddam. This sounds fine for most people in America and Britain. What could be more natural than celebrating the end of the Beast of Baghdad? But Iraqis, a proud people who have resisted centuries of invasions, realised that their new public holiday would honour the first day of their country's foreign occupation. Nice one. From its very first decision, an Iraqi journalist told me with contempt, the interim council delegitimised itself. Now the council's members are falling out because its Kurdish members refuse to accept Turkish troops in Iraq. The US administration wants these soldiers, as it wanted Indian soldiers, to be the cannon fodder against the Iraqi guerrillas so that the Americans can retreat to desert camps and lower their casualties. So the Bush administration is prepared to risk the interim council's future, the only tangible step in its promise of democracy for Iraq, if it means saving American lives. Didn't say that before the war, did they? And so there has begun to grow the faint but sinister shadow of a different kind of democracy for Iraq, one in which a new ruler will have to use a paternalistic rule, moderation mixed with autocracy, a la Ataturk, to govern Iraq and allow the Americans to go home or hide in the desert. Inevitably, it has been one of the commentators from the same failed right as Wolfowitz, Daniel Pipes from the so-called Middle East Forum, to express this in its most chilling form. He now argues that democratic-minded autocrats, I'll repeat that again, democratic-minded autocrats can guide the country, German for guide is Führer, remember, can guide the country to full democracy better than snap elections. What Iraq needs, Pipe says, is a democratically minded strongman who has real authority, who would be politically moderate but operationally tough. I've spent 27 years in the Middle East studying these creatures. We're going to have another one, right? Yes, it's difficult to resist a cynical smile at such double standards, although their meaning is frightening enough. What does operationally tough mean, other than secret policemen, interrogation rooms, and torturers to keep the people in order, which is exactly what Saddam set up when he took power, supported as he was at the time by the United States and Britain? What does strongman mean, other than a total reversal of the promise of democracy, which President Bush and Mr. Blair, our own dear Mr. Blair, made to the Iraqi people? Democracies are not led by autocrats, and autocrats are not led by anyone but themselves. The Pipes version of the strongman democracy, by the way, involves the withdrawal of American troops to military bases away from population centres, where they serve as the military partner of the new government, guaranteeing its ultimate security. In other words, US forces would hide in the desert to avoid further casualties unless it was necessary to reinvade Baghdad to get rid of the strongman if he failed to obey our orders. But today, Bremer remains the strongman, even if under Condoleezza Rice's odd guidance. And under his rule, US troops are losing hearts and minds by the bucketful with each new, blundering, and often useless raid against the civilians of Iraq. Still obsessed with capturing, or rather killing, Saddam, they are destroying any residual affection for them among large numbers of the population. On a recent operation in the town of Duluaya, for example, two innocent men were killed, and the America's Iraqi informer, originally paraded before those he was to betray in a hood to keep his identity secret, was executed by his own father. Little mistake the Americans made when they took the hood off. They had several released Iraqi prisoners present. The enterprising newspaper Iraq Today found that the intelligence officers of the 4th Infantry Division even left behind their mugshots, aerial reconnaissance photographs, and secret operational documents, complete with target houses and briefing notes, at the scene. They forgot to take them with them. The paper, in the true tradition of journalism, gleefully published the lot, including the comment of the father of Sabah Salem Kerbul, the young informer who worked for the Americans during Operation Peninsula Strike. He shot his son first in the foot and then in the head. "I have killed him," he said, "but he is still a part of my heart." Indeed, anarchic violence is now being embedded in Iraqi society in a way it never was under the genocidal Saddam. Scarcely a day goes by when I do not encounter the evidence of this in my daily reporting work in Baghdad. Visiting the Yarmouk Hospital in Baghdad, for example, to seek the identity of civilians killed by American troops in Mansour the previous day, I came across four bodies lying out in the yard beside the building in the 50-degree heat. The refrigerators were full. All had been shot. No one knew their identities. They were all young, save for what might have been a middle-aged man with a hole in his sock. 3 days earlier, on a visit to a local supermarket, I noticed that the woman cashier was wearing black. Yes, she said, because her brother had been murdered a week earlier. No one knew why. In a conversation with my driver's father, who runs a photocopying shop quite close to Bremer's palace headquarters, a young man suddenly launched into praise for Saddam Hussein. When I asked him why, he said that his father's new car had just been stolen by armed men. Trying to contact an ex-prisoner who had been illegally held by the Americans at his home in a slum suburb of Baghdad, I drove to the local Mukhtar's house to find the correct address. The Mukhtar is the local mayor, as many of you will know. But I was greeted by a group of long-faced relatives who told me that I could not speak to the Mukhtar because he had been assassinated the previous night. So if this is just my experience, in just 4 days, how many murders and thefts are occurring across Baghdad, indeed across Iraq? Only a month ago, for example, 5 men accused of selling alcohol were murdered in Basra. All of them were Christians. Again, there was no publicity, no official statement, no death toll from the occupation authorities. Then I sat in the conference hall, which the occupation authorities use for their daily press briefings, follies, as we call them, which are used to condemn irresponsible reporting, here we go again, but which record only a fraction of the violence of the previous 24 hours. Violence, of course, which is well known to the authorities. 39 bodies, hands and feet tied, neatly executed with a bullet in the back of the neck, have been found in Basra in just the last 4 weeks. No word on this, of course, from the Anglo-American occupation authorities. I'll come back to these statistics later. Then there was a disturbing moment at the press conference of the CPA when Charles Heatley, the British spokesman from the British Foreign Office, appointed by Tony Blair at the behest of Alistair Campbell, the press advisor who's just resigned because of the Kelly inquiry, he talked about the reports of abduction and rape in Iraq. He acknowledged there'd been some cases, but then I enjoyed the beautiful way in which he tried to destroy any journalistic interest in this subject. He talked about the number of rumours which turned out to be untrue when checked out. Oh yes, he said, you know, we hear this, we go to the uncle, he says the cousin knows, and then we find it's not true. But this is not the experience of The Independent, which in just one day recently discovered the identity of a young woman who had been kidnapped, raped, and then freed only to attempt suicide three times at her home. Another family gave our paper a photograph of their abducted daughter in the hope that it might be reprinted in the Iraqi press. The occupation authorities took no interest, and she is still missing. I know that because her wanted picture is glued to the gate of the Baghdad city morgue. Why don't the occupation authorities realize that Iraq cannot be spun? This country is living a tragedy of epic proportions, and now, after its descent into hell under Saddam, we are doomed to suffer its contagion. By our hubris and by our lies and by our fantasies, including the fantasies of our own dear Mr. Blair, we are descending into the pit. For the people of Iraq, the next stage in their Calvary is underway. For us, a new colonial humiliation, the like of which may well end the careers of Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair. It's coming.
That was the first half of a two-part speech by the award-winning British journalist, author, and filmmaker Robert Fisk. He spoke in October 2003 in Berkeley, California. Fisk has traveled the Middle East for the last quarter century, returning to his home in Beirut between journeys. In the upcoming part of his talk, he describes the very amicable 20-year-long relationship between the U.S. government and Saddam Hussein. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Robert Fisk on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a one-hour copy of the complete talk by Robert Fisk on the Fantasy War by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.